Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to a new episode of Talk Back with C.E. Moore. This time around, fiction editor Melissa Willis joins me on the line as we have the distinct pleasure of sitting down and talking with New York Times bestselling author Frank Peretti about his newest novel, Illusion.
But Frank, thank you so much for taking the time to call in. You're calling in to talk about your new book, Illusion, which is your first book in a long time, I want to say 4 or 5 years at this point. Tell us a little bit about Illusion, without ruining it for people. Obviously, we want them to run out and buy the book. But talk a little bit about this story. What's it about?
Okay, well, you start off with Dane and Mandy. They are two people who have been married and in love for 40 years. And they are stage magicians. They go all over the place. They're a magic act. They've been a famous magic act for 40 years. And then there's this terrible car wreck, and Mandy is supposedly killed, but that's where all the intrigue starts, because Dane moves up to Idaho, which incidentally I'm from. Dane moves up just to kind of rebuild his life and mourn his loss, and really grieving for his lost wife. In the meantime, Mandy wakes up on the fairgrounds of the Spokane County Fair, and she is the 19-year-old girl she was clear back in 1970. And to her, she never lived that 40 years. She was at the fairgrounds in 1970, and suddenly, bam, she's at the fairgrounds in exactly the same place, and it's 2010. So she's lost. She doesn't know where all of her friends have gone. She has no ID, no way of knowing who she is. She ends up in a mental ward because people think she's crazy. What do you mean, girl? She thinks she's from 1970. Here it is 2010. So anyway, she has this incredible journey that starts trying to figure out what in the world has happened to her, which, of course, we're going to find out as the book unfolds. But in the course of all this, she runs into a 60-year-old man who begins to mentor her and teach her how to be a good magician and how to get along in life and so forth. So that happens to be Dane, and he thinks he's going crazy because, yeah, it must be his grief for his lost wife. Now he's looking at this girl, and she looks just exactly like the girl that he fell in love with and married 40 years ago. In the meantime, she's strangely drawn to him. And then the intrigue starts from there and just kind of gets more and more exciting with good guys and bad guys and the mystery and some sci-fi and all kinds of fun things.
Okay.
Now there's three, well, I say three main plots. There's a lot of plots, but I kind of narrowed them down to three main plots. But then they all come together in the end. You talked about Dane and Mandy kind of finding each other, and then Mandy's got this just incredible knack for illusions. And then there's also a little bit of the question as to how she managed to be where she's at, and why she's 19 years old. Which was your personal favorite of those storylines to write, and why?
Oh, man. They were all a lot of fun. I think my favorite storyline was just the relationship that builds between the two of them, because it's so deeply emotional. And boy, it kind of made me all the more fond for my own dear wife. I'd get done writing, I'd come back in the house and give her a big hug, and I'd be so thankful we're still in love. She enjoyed my writing this book. It just brought us closer together.
I am, you know, Calvin and I joke about my black heart because I'm not one for romance. That just drives me nuts. But I loved the love that was shown between Dane and Mandy. I thought that was just beautiful overall. And so that I can go for. That kind of romance and love story, I'll buy any day.
What's neat about this is a different kind of love story, because your usual formulaic love story is two people who've never met each other, and they meet each other, and through obstacles and adventures, they finally fall in love, and by the end of the story, they're kissing and hugging, and the music is playing, and the birds are singing. This is a story of two people who have already been in love, have been married for 40 years, and now are taking a whole fresh look at it and rediscovering it all over again. So it's a really interesting approach. I really enjoyed it.
Now, Melissa, I need to correct Melissa there. We don't joke about her black heart. We normally joke about her not even having a heart. There's a difference.
Oh, she has a heart. She likes my book.
let's talk a little bit about science and progress within this story, because most of the time the characters seem to start off with good ideas or good intentions, and they have a tendency to veer off track and go down a slippery slope. You kind of played around with that idea a little bit in the book, well, quite a bit in the book Monster. But in Illusion, the original intent of the scientist was noble, but the result was less than ethical. Talk about this part of the novel, and where do you think that they should have ended their experiment?
Oh, well, we can't give away too much of the book, but let's see. Let's stick with the moral aspect of it. That you know what? It almost goes back to that famous line by Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, where he says to the scientists who have brought back these dinosaurs, he says, "You were so excited about the fact that you could, you never thought about whether you should."
Right.
And that's kind of a common theme in horror stories. I mean, clear back as far as Frankenstein is the scientist who becomes obsessed with some kind of godhood and wants to conquer nature to the point that he has control over life and death. And that is the thematic thing going on here with our dark, mysterious scientists working behind the scenes in this story. Is they kind of become obsessed with their own godhood, their own ability to make their own rules and call their own shots, and that's what gets them in trouble. And this is, it's a common theme. A lot of stories appeal to us to be careful what you're doing, because too much power is going to warp your thinking, and you're going to end up doing the wrong thing just because you can.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, I agree completely. That makes so much sense to me. I think that's why the books resonate so much to me. It's like, yeah, this is so true, and I wish more people thought like this. We have so many things, of course, going on in our own society, so that's why I think it appeals to me. You look at the real world, and you're like, wow. I think some scientists were, like, working on, like, a more virulent strain of the avian bird flu, and people were going, why? Why are you doing that? That can be weaponized and kill a lot of people. Maybe you shouldn't do that. And they ended up stopping, thankfully. But I think that's why this kind of stuff in your books resonates so deeply with me. It's because people are doing these kinds of things out in the real world. And so,
well, it's interesting that technologically we've advanced incredibly, but morally we've actually regressed a little bit. And very high, powerful, sophisticated technology in the hand of a wayward child is a very dangerous thing. And so there's that little cry. That's one part of the book that cries out in that regard.
Absolutely.
Continue along kind of the same line of thought here on their experiments, but I want to take it outside of the book and put it in the real world. And when we're faced with these kind of discoveries and advances, what do you think the question or questions should be that guide and determine when a scientist has went too far, particularly when we're talking about those that don't share a Christian worldview? Because I think those that have a Christian worldview have a more grounded moral compass. But what about those that don't?
Well, with those that don't, the only thing you can do is appeal to a pragmatic point of view. You're going to have to ask, is this really ultimately beneficial to the human race? And it's not just a matter of survival. It's a matter of survival as what? Are we going to be better people if this is implemented? Just because we're able to defeat disease and prolong life and postpone death, what does this cost us? Are we less human at the end of it than we were before? This is where life becomes a commodity. It becomes dispensable. And just like, oh man, the age-old abortion debate, what people overlook is the foundational assumption in the pro-choice position, and that is that the value and the definition of human life are arbitrary. Any individual, for him or herself, can decide what a human life is and what it is worth. You see, we've already crossed that line that separates us from a civilized society, that separates a civilized society from a race of barbarians. You can be a very, very sophisticated barbarian in a white lab coat and think you're above it, but you're not.
Yeah, and by the way, the book you wrote, Tilly, I remember reading that one. That it was abortion related, and I worked for Crisis Pregnancy Center for a lot of years, and that was one that book got passed around quite a bit, and read it. It was very good. Very much enjoyed it.
Well, that's an example of a book that speaks purely on the human level. Some people could present scientific or philosophical or technological or logical arguments and toss around, what human life is, and we don't know when it really starts, and conception, blah, 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 blah. But when all the dust settles, at the end of the day, we are still human beings, and there is something very special about us that makes us concerned at a heart level for the real meaning of things, for right and for wrong. It's kind of like C.S. Lewis once said. He says, we scoff at honor, and then we're just horrified to find traitors in our midst.
Okay.
You know, there is such a thing as honor. There is such a thing as truth and virtue and honesty. And, you know, all these actors in Hollywood turn out all these movies that show them hopping from bed to bed and partner to partner, but just wait till their real-life partner betrays them, and then it's a whole other story.
Right.
There are aspects to life that are unavoidable, and we as human beings have to be willing to face that. And that's some of the deeper issues being presented in this book.
Yes, that is true.
Now, let's turn the conversation a little. The Christian, we talk a lot about Christian fiction, and we talk to a lot of authors in the Christian fiction world and a few who are in the quote-unquote secular market. But the Christian fiction market has changed significantly since the release of This Present Darkness, which is, you know, the book that, you know, I guess you're most known for. It's kind of like, you know, Leonard Nimoy always being known as Spock. So I wonder if it always bothers you. Like, you've written so many books since then. Does it drive you crazy that everyone's like, oh, I love This Present Darkness. But having read all your books, Illusion seems to be very different from your previous novels, especially in the manner in which the spiritual themes are presented. Like, your earlier works tended to be more overt in their presentation of, like, the faith and the gospel, while Illusion is quite subtle. Talk about the changes in your style from your earliest books to Illusion, and what do you think is the primary catalyst for those changes?
I guess I'm trying to just reach towards something that is a little more artistic, with a little more depth. It's a struggle, because I want to be true to the Christian message. And I guess I take a little bit of my inspiration from C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Narnia series, which never blatantly preaches the gospel, and yet it's all gospel-oriented in an allegorical way. And I was just trying my hand at that, because I do want to be able to appeal to a wider audience, not just an evangelical audience that knows the language. You see, you can write a book and just speak Christianese through the whole thing. And I know some folks would prefer it that way. But I want to grow as a writer, and I want my readers to grow as readers. And I want people not just to agree and say amen when I throw the same scriptures at them every time. I want them to think a little deeper about the real issues that we as human beings, Christian or otherwise, all have to face, because we're all made by the same God, and we all have the same issues. And if I can present a treatment of a particular life issue, in this case, love, devotion, fidelity. If I can treat that from a Christian worldview and show that there is a beautiful thing called marriage that God created, if I can show that there is within all of us a longing to find God, to find our Savior, we're empty without Him, then okay, good. I've accomplished my purpose. As far as I'm concerned, this book, if I can just get people a little more respectful and thankful for the institution of marriage and love, well, that in itself is a goal right there I'd be happy to accomplish.
Now, many people credit you with kind of creating this Christian, supernatural, speculative genre, the spiritual warfare. I know we had C.S. Lewis and the Screwtape Letters kind of prior to that, but what do you see as your role in the development of this genre, and what do you think about how it's developed and the direction that it's going?
Oh, I have mixed feelings about it. I, as a writer and an artist, you know, I've had some quandaries even myself about, well, how far over the edge or close to the edge do we want to go with this? I know some of the books have gotten really dark and quite violent. And I was involved in a few projects that, for me, went over the line, and I was bothered about it. And it's actually caused me to kind of react negatively. I've kind of backed away from it. When I did Illusion, as I was planning the book, I already knew ahead of time I was not going to get real dark and violent. I wasn't going to start using knives and witchcraft and boogeymen and I don't know. It's just, if this is just me, these other writers and readers can create and consume what they wish. But as for me, I'd rather kind of back away from that stuff and try to find a creative outlet in the deeper issues of the human heart and not quite appeal so much to the dark, violent, bloody side of things.
Do you find the, I don't know, I guess you would say the use of like vampires and other zombies and things like that to kind of be sort of a tipping point, or kind of where do you find that it goes almost too far to the dark side? I guess you could say that sounds Star Wars-ish, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, that's hard to say. I do know one thing. I'm a little, I kind of am dismayed, a little disappointed that the force of the marketplace is that powerful that Christian authors just seek to mimic whatever's hot out there. I mean, zombies and vampires, hasn't that been done? That's disappointing to me.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, that's actually how I kind of felt about, House. As you said, you've pulled away from some of your books. I actually ended up reading that book and then seeing the movie, and the movie was terrifying. And, of course, Hollywood does their own thing. Once it's in the screenwriter's hands, they can do what they want with it. But no swearing, no blood, no gore in the film, but still terrified me and disturbed me. And I was like, wow, I don't know how much of this I could take as part of my daily diet. But you see now a lot of people who are reading Christian fiction are like, I want it darker and darker and darker. And you see authors defending, well, it's got to be truly dark in order to show the light later on. And I can understand that, but part of me is still like, I don't know that I need to know how pitch black something is. I just need to know that it's dark. I don't need to be the darkest that it can be in order for me to enjoy the triumph of light over, light over darkness. But that's a whole other conversation we could go on for hours about. Talk a little bit. I know this might be premature because your books come out so few and far between, which is why, again, we thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. But what's next for you? What's coming out of the pipeline for Frank Peretti next?
Well, I'd like to write another book, believe it or not.
Yay!
I spent so many years between the last book and this one trying to get something going in motion pictures and film. That's one of the reasons there was such a big gap there. And I came away from that experience, about 5-year stretch there. I'm discouraged. I mean, I'm disillusioned about all that. I gave it a good try, and, I guess I failed, but I'm not disappointed in that. I'd rather live with failure than with regret. I'm smarter now. I gave it a try. It didn't work. All right. I'm going to go back to writing books because I know if I write a book, I'll actually get something done. People will see it, and that can make a difference in this world. It's better than beating your head against a wall.
What is the best place for people to find out more about you and your books so that we'll all be ready when the next one shows up?
Well, I guess the quickest way, believe it or not, is my webpage, frankperetti.com. And then, of course, I'm on Facebook. And I think now that I'm back in the game again and writing, there will be, you'll hear about it in the press and the media and everything. I'll probably disappear for another 2 years and then pop up with another book.
Well, it is certainly good to have you back. In fact, I have been seriously defending that day that you're in Dallas on Saturday. I mean, I have got that blocked off on my calendar. I have been fending off any appointments that have popped up on that Saturday.
You're going to be there?
Yeah, I'm planning to be there.
Oh, okay, great. Come on up and introduce yourself. That'd be great to meet you.
I sure will, and I will bring my faithful Kindle because I like to have my cases signed by authors. So.
Okay.
Well, Frank, we want to be mindful of your time, so we just want to let you go. But thank you so much again for taking the time to join us and answer some of our burning questions. You have been an author who both Melissa and I have respected for a number of years now. We've liked all of your books. Thank you for answering some of our questions today.
Well, you had some really good questions. I enjoyed our discussion very much.
All right. You have a great afternoon.